The first time I recall singing in public, I was in the second grade. I'm sure that I sang in church before that, but I don't really have a memory of that.
That's Jessie Norman, opera and concert singer extraordinaire.
But I remember being in second grade, and it was a huge school in the segregated South, at least 1,200 kids. And every Friday, the school would all come together in the auditorium. And so it was the responsibility of a class, you know, either the second grade or the third grade or the fourth grade, to kind of present a kind of program on each of the Fridays. And it was now time for the second grade students to do this. And my teacher at the time said, "Well, then you should sing Norman." I was always called by my last name. And so she said, "You can sing Norman because you sing so loudly, we won't have to sort of lower the microphone from the principal when you're singing on stage." I took it to be a compliment.
So loud was there from the get-go, but great wasn't too far behind. Jessie Norman has sung leading roles with the finest opera companies and orchestras in the world, not to mention solo recitals and performances for presidents and queens and historic occasions. She's such a global icon that when France was celebrating the bicentennial of its revolution, then President François Mitterrand asked her to sing the Marseillaise. Even people who've never listened to an opera in their life know her name. The divine voice and the charmed life story of Jessie Norman on today's What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for. But boy, you better not miss him.
Jessie Norman was born in Augusta, Georgia in 1945. Her parents, an insurance salesman and a school teacher, taught her she could do anything.
That's exactly what my parents said to me. You're going to have to work twice as hard, but you can do anything that you want to. And I believed it. I truly believed it.
Jessie Norman talked about her childhood, her original plan to become a doctor, and her path to the world's greatest concert halls with the Academy of Achievement in 2012. The interviewer was Barbara Harrison, a longtime Washington, D.C. television journalist.
How does one find one's voice? How do you know when you're a little girl that there's a voice inside of you that can come out and make the kind of music that you make?
Well, when I was really very young, I mean, my parents told me that I started singing at the same time that I started speaking. So I have absolutely no memory of not singing. And it was and remains, thank goodness, a very natural thing for me to do because I've always done it. I was in the children's choir at the church and the choir at the school in first grade and all the rest of it. And it wasn't that I had such an interesting voice. It was just a very loud voice. And so for a five-year-old or a six-year-old, I could always sing on my own and be heard, you see. So that was the interesting part at that time. I hope that things have changed over time.
Well, what is amazing to me, though, is that an operatic voice is so different from the voices that we hear in church and on the radio, and especially when we were girls,
yeah, sure.
The kind of music that was being played. My mother called it gut bucket music.
I don't know. I'm sure, absolutely.
She didn't like it, but operatic. Operatic music was something that many of us did not hear.
Well, I happen to You know, it was the very funny thing because I was given my very own radio. I know that most kids sort of listening to this right now would just burst out laughing. But it was the greatest thing in the world. I was given my very own radio in my very own bedroom, which meant I could listen to anything that I wanted to. I didn't have to invite my brothers. I could close the door. And if I wanted to listen to Gunsmoke or to Elvis Presley or to the Metropolitan Opera on Saturdays, I could do that. And I would listen to the Metropolitan Opera because they had the most wonderful announcer. His name was Milton Cross. And Milton Cross would tell you everything you needed to know about the opera. Of course, I didn't sort of understand Italian or French or German or any of these things. But I didn't need to, because Milton Cross told you everything you needed to know. He told you what Joan Sutherland was wearing, that she was very tall, that she was wearing a very beautiful blonde wig, and that her costume for Lucia de Lammermoor was this beautiful teal blue color. So I could see all of this in my mind. And however long the opera lasted on a Saturday afternoon, that's how long it took me to clean my room.
After shouting, "Vive la morte insieme," the lovers, Maddalena and Chenier, hand in hand, mounted the prison stairs. They stood embraced on the open prison balcony against the brightening streaks of early dawn. The shadow or silhouette of the guillotine.
Milton Cross was the host of the Metropolitan Opera's Saturday matinee broadcast for 43 years, from 1931 when it first began until 1975 when he passed away. Jesse Norman didn't sing on the Metropolitan Opera stage until 8 years after his death, so it seems unlikely that Milton Cross ever knew his part in sparking her career. But he certainly deserves a standing ovation for it. Of course, Milton Cross wasn't the only one to foster Jesse Norman's passion for opera and concert music. Her friends growing up may not have shared her enthusiasm.
But you see, I had the luck of having several teachers, already in the fourth grade of Mrs. Printup, and then in the fifth grade of Mrs. Hughes, and in the sixth grade, by the time I'm 11, of Mrs. Williams. And they knew that I was interested in this, and they also knew that my classmates were not. So on a Monday, after I'd sort of listened to the opera, if I'd sort of listened to the opera that Saturday, I would be asked by my various teachers, "Now, would you like to tell us what it was you heard on the radio on Saturday?" I was happy to. The kids were bored to tears. You can just imagine it. You know, some 10-year-old boys sort of sitting there listening to some girl go on about Leontine Price singing Aida. I mean, really, what is Aida anyway? And I would tell the story because I'd make notes when Milton Cross was sort of telling us what was going on so that I would be prepared. And so I had my little sort of shtick every kind of Monday morning, you know, sort of during the course of the year when the opera was on, that I might be called upon to talk about the opera. So I arrived with my notes and bored the class to absolute tears for at least 15 minutes.
What a fantastic story. And did you try to sing some of those sounds that you had heard, those kinds of notes?
No, I didn't try to reach those kinds of notes, but one of the operas, a wonderful septet from an opera of Donizetti, the one that I mentioned earlier, Lucia de Lammermoor, it has such a beautiful, beautiful ensemble. And I memorized the tune because it was so pretty for my ears. And I had remembered it by the time sort of Monday turned around and I could talk about it to the class. And that was the one time that I think the boys in the class actually listened to what I was saying.
Can you hum it? What was it? What is it?
I mean, just the most beautiful tune
it's just amazing to hear you hum.
I mean,
really, that instrument, that's what is so incredible. You have this instrument. I mean, people play the drums, they play horns, but you have an instrument that is you.
That is inside the body.
And one how do you feel about that?
Well, it is a responsibility. I'm very grateful for it. But at the same time, it can really get on other people's nerves, you know, saying, well, we have to turn off the air conditioning and I mustn't be in a draft and all the rest of it. Everybody else is, you know, sort of fanning themselves because it's so hot. And I'm sitting there saying, but I can't be in air conditioning because it will give me sinusitis and all the rest of it. And sometimes, particularly the little people in my family will say, can't you just take your voice out and put it on the table so that we can sit in the car in Atlanta, Georgia in the summer with the air conditioning on, please?
And people mistake that for being a diva.
Oh, yes. For being difficult.
Yes, but it's not, but they don't get it.
They don't get it. They don't understand that all you're doing is trying to preserve your sort of work activity. This is your profession. And people would prefer that you show up sort of not hoarse and with sinusitis and everything else going on that can happen from having a cold.
We've read that you come from a very musical family. What was the role of music in your house when you were growing up?
There was music all the time. The boys in my family played instruments in the bands at schools because my father was the president of the PTA and my mother was the secretary of the PTA. And, you know, parents in those days would not have allowed the kind of things that are happening with the school's curriculum these days all over the country and all over the world, that the arts are simply dropping out of the curriculum. They wouldn't have allowed it. They knew how much being a member of the chorus or a member of the movement group or a member of the poetry society or a member of the band, they realized how much this influenced everything else in our lives and that it was a part of education that really is just too important to be left aside. And so music was in my house all the time. My mother played piano. And one of the things that I talk about all the time is at Christmas time, we would do a version, if you can imagine it, of Messiah's the Hallelujah Chorus. Now, with my mother playing the piano and I'm singing all of the parts of the chorus, and one of my brothers is playing the tuba, somebody else is playing the trumpet, and somebody else is playing the trombone, we would simply look at the music and choose a line of it to play. And there we were sort of doing this thing that really calls for a chorus and an orchestra, not five people in the hallway on the upright piano sort of doing. So if we hadn't known, I always say, if we hadn't known where Handel was buried at the time, we would have found out from the Norman rendition of the Hallelujah Chorus because he was certainly spinning in his grave.
How beautiful, how lucky to have parents who understood the importance of music and the arts.
Yes, yes, they understood that.
When did you first know what you wanted to do? What is it that struck you about singing and music?
Well, I understood about singing and music, of course, as I said, from a very early age, but I didn't understand about getting paid for singing. Because as a child, of course, you know, you get something to drink and two butter cookies as a thank you for coming, you know, to whatever it is and singing. And that was even more than one expected, you know. You expected to have somebody shake your hand and say thank you, and that was the kind of end of it. So the whole idea of becoming sort of one of these people singing on the radio from the Metropolitan Opera on a Saturday, that was very far from my mind because I had no idea as to how one would do that. But I did understand my other passion, which remains a passion of mine, which is medicine. It happens that the University of Georgia Medical School is in Augusta, Georgia, where I was born. Yeah. So I saw people in white coats all the time going back and forth. I understood about going to university and then going to medical school and then getting a job. So up until age 17, which by this time I had a scholarship to come to Howard University to study in the College of Fine Arts, I was still making sure as a student in high school that I had the credits that I would need in order to go to liberal arts at Howard University and to prepare to go to pre-med.
Wow, so you were thinking of becoming a doctor?
Absolutely, very much so.
And had your parents known that?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Did they push you in that direction?
No, I tell the story all the time about my mother coming through my bedroom when I was getting ready to go to university. And you know how it is if you're going off to university or something the first time or going off to camp, you start packing long before you're supposed to go. You think you've got so many things and such a lot of things to organize that you start very early. This was weeks before I needed to show up in Washington. And my mother, who had a very special way of walking, sort of came through my bedroom. She said, "Well, darling, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but you do have a full scholarship to study music at Howard University. But make up your own mind."
So she was really interested in your following a musical career.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Because at that time, so many people were pushing, especially African-American kids, to get into the sciences.
Oh, absolutely. And to have a sure way of earning a living.
Right.
And I was just very lucky. And we talk about all that. We talk about this a great deal with my siblings, that our parents were so supportive without sort of being on our necks. How did they do that?
Did any of your brothers and sister, you have one sister.
One sister, yes.
So any siblings go into music as well?
Nope. They went into medicine.
Oh, really? They saw those white coats, too.
They saw those white coats, too. But they participate very much in music. My older brother, Silas, who's an internist and actually the dean of admissions at Wayne State University, the medical college there, and a professor of internal medicine, he sings in a choir. They sing with the Detroit Symphony and all of those things and go on tour. So he's very much involved in music. And my sister happens to have just come back from London. I was working in Europe as well, because she sings in Wynton Marsalis's choir. And she's a nursing director, you know, but she still sings. It's wonderful.
Wow.
Yes.
So what experience or event in your life inspired you the most?
Oh, gosh, that would be very difficult to say. I don't know whether I would have to choose being inspired by just hearing my grandmother sing her way through the entire day. She had a song for every time of day. In the morning, there was a kind of quick song, a spiritual, that would be sort of rather faster than later in the day when she was perhaps more sort of contemplative or maybe just exhausted from the day. And I remember being taken by that she seemed to have her own kind of soundtrack that sort of accompanied her throughout the day. I didn't think of it in those terms as a young child, but now in reflection, I think about her having her own soundtrack.
Then there was the neighbor who knew about the unusual musical interests of the little girl next door, and she asked whether 9-year-old Jessie Norman would like to listen to her old 78 records.
And I said, yes, of course I would. And we didn't have a stereo player at the house, at our house that played 78s, but she had at her house that played 78s. So she gave me this stack of recordings and kind of left the room for me to have my own fun. And I found Marian Anderson's recording within this group of recordings that she had, and I'd heard that name already before. And I put that recording on, and I remember saying at the time that I was surprised that that was only a human voice. I thought that had to be something else. I didn't know that a woman could have that kind of vocal sound. I'd never heard it before.
Thank you.
she was singing the Brahms Alto Rhapsody. And I was listening to that on that record player, as one referred to them in those days. And even though I had no idea of the meaning of the words, they sounded important to me. And the music sounded important to me. And I listened to it over and over again. And on the occasion at Carnegie Hall, many, many years later, when we were having a memoriam, as by this time Marian Anderson had passed, this is in 1997, and when Robert Shaw said to me, "Let's do the Alto Rhapsody," I said, "Well, I might not get through it because I might cry all the way through it, because this is a very meaningful piece to me." But it was thrilling on that occasion, in her memory, to sing the first thing that I'd ever heard her sing ever.
Jesse Norman found in Marian Anderson a voice so extraordinary that it provided a lifetime of inspiration. But equally important, Marian Anderson was a personal role model, an African-American woman who had achieved the unthinkable, performing at the Lincoln Memorial in 1939 before a crowd of 75,000 people. A year after Jesse Norman first heard that majestic voice coming from her neighbor's record player, Marian Anderson broke the color barrier at the Metropolitan Opera. Jesse Norman was 10 years old by then, and she picked up the torch, becoming a figure of hope and transcendence for another generation. Here's Rhiannon Giddens, who studied opera at the Oberlin Conservatory and went on to co-found the phenomenal Carolina Chocolate Drops.
Jesse Norman was she was the singer that you couldn't copy. I mean, because she did her technique was amazing, but she did her thing. Like, she did it her way, and it was just like her mouth shapes and everything. It was like her. Like, don't do that. Listen and try to do that, but don't watch and try to do that. You know what I mean? Because it worked for her, and it was perfect, you know. I mean, she was the goddess, you know, with the hair and the way that she would claim a stage, the way I would watch interviews with her, and the way that she was just so fully in herself and so fully unapologetic for how powerful she was, that was really important for me.
Ann Giddens says she has tremendous appreciation for what it took for Jesse Norman and Marian Anderson, along with other pioneering women of color, to light the way for her.
Man, the ones who come first, it's always hard. You know, because you know full well that you are that role model for all those girls. You know what I mean? I know she knows that. She has to know that. You know, for all of us in the conservatory going, she did it, we can do it. You know, so when you are in that position and there's still not that many of you and you hold that place, I think it takes an incredible amount of willpower and inner strength to not lose yourself in that, you know, because this is the thing about African-American singers is that we understand that there's more to it than just singing. Like what our culture has been through, what we've been through as a people, there's more to it than singing. I mean, that's the way I see it. And that's how I looked up to them as not only amazing singers, but women who did it in a genre that didn't want them. You know what I mean? And they broke through and they did it unbelievably well to that nobody could even question them. I mean, that's incredibly hard. It's about more than just music.
Denise Graves, like Rhiannon Giddens, studied opera at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. Today, Graves is one of the world's most renowned sopranos. She was a teenager the first time she heard Jesse Norman.
And my voice teacher to me at the time said, there's a singer that you must hear, and we're going to hear her at the Kennedy Center. And so I went to hear her at the Kennedy Center recital. At that time, being a teenager, I didn't know all that I was hearing. It was later that I would come to appreciate her particular gift and her incredible discipline more and more and more as I grew and as I learned more about the business, what all that goes into it, because she was fiercely fanatical about everything that she did. And you always heard that I think in classical music, a lot of times we're in pursuit of perfection, and we're certainly taught to, you know, spin the most beautiful tones that we can. But apart from everything that we're doing technically, her singing was so intelligent. Particularly where opera's concerned, you have to really get into the language. You've got to get into the history. You've got to get into the technique. You've got to get into the character. And this is what she was a great artist at doing, at being a real well-rounded, thorough, and complete type of an artist. I went to a recital that she did once at Alice Tully Hall, years of the old Alice Tully Hall, of a German leader. And it was a class in the German language. That is what it was. With such incredible articulation and such care and such, as I said, fanatical finesse of everything that she did. There wasn't any tone that left her mouth that wasn't thoughtful. You could see that. You could see the work. I think that when we think of the word, you know, opera diva, it's her face. It's her face, you know? But and I don't mean that in the... I know that sometimes the word diva, it sort of had this negative connotation to it. I think that with her, it's grandness. She is a figure that commands a type of respect, you know? She's a great big personality, a real grande dame in every sense of the word. But that title is earned and has been hard won, particularly at the time that she came along. It isn't easy anyway, even today in 2018. They don't pass out careers. At the end of the day, the stage doesn't lie. I mean, you have to just deliver. When I was a student in Boston at New England Conservatory, she gave a concert at Symphony Hall, and I went backstage to meet her, and I said, Miss Norman, what can I possibly say to you that you haven't heard 1,000 times? And she said, my dear, I'm sure you can think of something.
Jesse Norman started earning her diva wings earlier in life than most. When she was 15, with absolutely no formal voice training, she applied to participate in the Marian Anderson Music Scholarship Competition in Philadelphia. She was under the age limit, but knew by the time the actual contest took place, she'd be just old enough.
What I didn't understand at the time is that it went from age 16 to age 30. So there would be people in this contest that had a great deal more experience than this 15-year-old from Augusta, Georgia. But anyway, along we went, and there's a marvelous story that goes with that as well, because my school principal decided that the school should participate in my going to Philadelphia. So on one particular day, and this is amazing when I think about it, he said that all of the children in this big school should, instead of spending their money for lunch, that they should give their money to me so that I would have extra money to go to Philadelphia. And the Board of Education paid for their lunch that day, so that there would be the act of their participating in my going to Philadelphia. Isn't that a wonderful story?
Wonderful. And I wonder if those kids remember.
Oh, yes.
And remembered,
oh, yes,
when they saw where you went in life.
Well, I still am sort of in contact with a great number of kids that I knew at that time. And even though I went to Philadelphia and I didn't win the contest, of course, I mean, I was probably the youngest person that ever showed up. But I recall so well that the sister of Marian Anderson came to me. She said, "Now, you are very young, but I want you to come back and sing for us once you've actually studied singing, because we're going to keep an eye on you." And as far as I was concerned, I had won everything. Marian Anderson's sister had actually spoken to me. But you see, on the way back from Philadelphia, because my teacher, who was accompanying me, Rosa Sanders, my high school music teacher, was accompanying me, and we stopped in Washington because we both had relatives here. And so we were sort of visiting near the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial and all of that. And in the middle of the day, she said, "Well, why don't we find out if anybody at Howard University is there and listen to you sing?" I said, "Well, that sounds like fun." You know, at that time, you don't care that you're tired and, you know, sort of perspiring from having sort of been sort of sightseeing all day long. It never occurs to you that you can't sing. And so she knew one of the professors at Howard because he had been a professor at Payne College in Augusta when she had been a student, and that's where she'd gone to school. So we just called this person. Dean Fax was his name, Mark Fax. And by now he was on faculty at the College of Fine Arts at Howard. And so we called and he said, "Well, why not? You know, there's a class this afternoon that's a master's degree class in vocal anatomy. So you could sing for that class." I said, "Why not? That's fine." So along we went and sang for that class, interrupted, you know, their studies and just sort of knocked on the door. And the professor at the time was told, you know, that I was there, and so she welcomed us into the class where there was a small piano, and I sort of sang a few songs. And that professor happened to be Carolyn Grant, who had been professor of voice at Howard University for about 42 years at the time. She accompanied me and my teacher out of the room once we finished our little performance, and she said, "How old are you?" And so I said, "I'm 16. I've just turned 16. I'm all grown up." And so she said, "Well, where are you in high school?" And so I said, "Well, I've got another year." And she said, "Well, I suppose you'd have to finish high school before you could come to school here." And I said, "Come to school here?" At that moment, she went down to the dean of the college and said, "I want to teach this child. Make sure that she comes to Howard University." That's how I happened to have a scholarship to Howard University.
Interviewer Barbara Harrison asked Jessie Norman what she thinks, in hindsight, Carolyn Grant saw in her that day.
I think that she saw great joy in the actual act of singing, and that even though I was walking into a classroom of people, and it was a small classroom, it wasn't a big auditorium, you know, and people were sitting all around me, and that I was comfortable in that situation, because, of course, that's the way you sing at church. I mean, if you're standing in church singing, I mean, there's somebody sitting in the front row, there's somebody sitting on the side, there are the deacons sitting to your right, so it's not like you're on a platform performing. And so I think that she saw a certain degree of enthusiasm and a certain degree of happiness just being allowed to do it. And I think that sort of caught her eye.
After graduating from Howard University, she continued her voice training at the Peabody Institute in Baltimore and then at University of Michigan, where she earned a master's degree and began to learn the languages of the classical repertoire. Then, through a remarkable set of circumstances, she went on to Europe alone at 23 to begin her singing career.
It's a wonderful story. A very wealthy industrialist by the name of J. Ralph Corbett from Cincinnati, Ohio, happened to be married to a person who had wanted to be a singer And so she was supportive of the Cincinnati Opera, and they supported practically single-handedly the Cincinnati Symphony. And so they wanted to broaden their kind of interest in sort of supporting young American singers. And so they had the idea, along with some people in the musical world, in classical music that they trusted, and had discussions about how they might help American singers to sort of get going, because there really wasn't sort of a lot of support, financial support. And so they had the brilliant idea that instead of having American singers to traipse all over Europe at a certain point singing for various directors of opera houses, that because they were in a position to do so financially, they would invite 25 directors of opera houses from all over Europe to come to the United States for 2 weeks, to wine and dine them in New York, to take them to the concerts, to the opera, to the theater, and during the day they had to sit there and listen to American singers all day long. And somehow I was invited to be a part of this. And I went along at my appointed time. It was in New York, and sang for this group of directors from opera houses all over the place. And I sang the second aria from Tannhäuser, which is one of the early operas of Wagner. And it was a very good choice, because you're only accompanied by the brass instruments in the orchestra, which means unless you have very good breath control, you can't do this aria. It is very slow and it's very hymn-like in the way that it's composed. It's not sort of, you know, sort of a lot of orchestral accompaniment, you know, that is kind of brilliant and spectacular. It really is a prayer. And so either you can pull it off or you can't. You really can't sort of cheat on it. And it's, again, you know, one of these fantasy stories. Egon Zehfelner was one of the directors that was sitting there. He actually came backstage after I finished my little presentation, and he said to me, "Do you know the rest of that opera?" And so I said, "No, but I could know it by next week." And he said, "No, it doesn't need to be quite so early. You would have time." So this was in May of the year, and he said, "I have looked at my calendar all through the time that you were singing, and I could offer you a date in November to sing this opera at my opera house." I said, "Fine, wonderful. I mean, at 23, what is not possible, you know?" And so I said, "That sounds like a good idea. Wow. Thank you very much." So I set about working that opera backwards and forwards and up and down. I knew everybody's part. I went to Duke University to study conversational German, because I had no intention of going to Germany and not being able to talk. It just, because I didn't know whether or not people spoke English. I simply, there was no reason that I could imagine this. And so it sounds like I'm making it up, but I went to rehearsals and went to my costume fittings, which were rather different from having a costume fitting at the University of Michigan for the offers that we did there. And I sang the performance, and after the second act, which is the act in which my character first appears, Egon Zehfelner actually came to my dressing room. The opera wasn't finished. And he said, "This is going very well. I'd like to offer you a 3-year contract." Wow. And so I said, "But Dr. Zehfelner, I haven't finished the opera." And he said, "That's the aria that you sang, the aria that's coming up in the third act. That's the one that you sang in New York, and I know that you can sing it."
Amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, it truly is amazing. I mean, one has to understand, think about this. 1969, the Berlin, December of 1969, just a little bit before Christmas, the Berlin Opera House an African-American singing a quintessential German character in a Wagnerian opera in a German opera house. There was a standing ovation at the end of the opera, I think, because everybody was just so surprised. It is completely crazy when you think about it, but that's what happened to me.
And the rest is history.
Well, yes, we're still trying to make it.
Well, believe me, I think the whole world knows that you've made it, but was there ever a stumbling moment, ever?
After being at the Opera House for 3 years and singing Elsa and Elizabeth, the Wagner roles that are not sort of the heavy Wagner roles, and then sort of Mozart operas that, of course, suited my voice at the time, I was continually sort of invited to sing things that I just felt I shouldn't. Things that I thought, well, no, I really don't think I should sing that now. I need to sing that maybe in 5 years or maybe in 10 years, but not right now. Couldn't I please sing something else? And that became a difficulty for me. And so I took it upon myself to go to speak with the artistic director to say that I thought I should leave the opera house and come back in some years when my maturity sort of chronologically would have caught up with the invitations that I was being offered. And of course, considering that he'd taken me into the opera house when I knew one role, he wasn't all that happy. I thought he'd say, oh, how what a smart girl. Oh, yes, absolutely. That's what we'll do. No, he was absolutely furious.
But at 24 years old, did you have someone telling you these things? Or did you know yourself that you weren't ready?
Well, I went because Berlin, imagine Berlin at the time. Herbert von Karajan directing the Berlin Philharmonic. You had all of these wonderful, I lived across the street from the Schiller Theater, which is still one of the great sort of theaters in Germany, where I would go and listen to really well-spoken German. And so there was a lot that I was learning just from being in that particular place at the time. And so I went to the opera practically every night. I went to something practically every night, just learning and seeing and absorbing. And what I noticed is that there were singers that were only sort of slightly older than I, whose voices sounded as though they were many decades older than that and didn't sound pretty. And I needed to understand what was happening. Their voices should have sounded fresh and blooming and wonderful, but instead they sounded different. And it was because they were singing a different opera every night and singing whatever was offered. And I didn't understand why they just didn't say no. Why didn't they just say, oh no, I don't think I should? Because it certainly could have happened that I could have been fired earlier in the process, but I didn't have sense enough to worry about that. It isn't as though I had, you know, sort of sheaves and sheaves of work. I made this decision because I was trying to save myself. I have always sung more solo recitals with piano than opera, but it isn't as though I had sort of, you know, recitals lined up all over the world. I had two or three things that I knew that were coming up, but I didn't have a lot after that. So at that point in my very young life, I wasn't sure whether or not I was going to be able to continue, because it wasn't certain that I would have enough work as a solo performer to support myself. And so there were probably about 2 months before I actually told my parents what I'd done. And when I called them, and my mother was on one extension and my father was on sort of the other one, which was in the kitchen, and there was stunned silence. And my father said, well, sister, how is it going since you've left the opera house in Berlin? And so I said, well, actually, I have 2 recitals in this place and another recital in that place, and I think I'm going to be all right. And at some point, mother said, do you need to come home? And so I said, no, I think I'm going to be all right.
Somehow she knew and had the gift of confidence.
Right around that time, 3 years after she'd arrived in Berlin, she began her recording career. This is from one of her earliest albums, made in 1972, with her frequent accompanist, Irwin Gage. And with that bit of sustenance, I want to pause here in the story and go back to just how Jessie Norman learned to speak and sing in beautifully fluent German, and then Italian, and French, and Spanish.
Determination. 5 hours a day for 6 months.
And then Italian. And yes, then all the other Spanish, languages yes. that you've mastered.
Yes. And I pride myself, except for Hebrew, which I sing because Rabbi Friedlander works with me every time I've got to sing in Hebrew. I don't pretend to speak Hebrew. But otherwise, I don't sing in languages that I don't speak.
Because?
Because I want to be able to express, I want to be able to communicate, and I want to be able to understand what it is I'm doing, and I want the people whose language it is to understand what it I'm doing. And to help me with that, I need to listen to people speaking their own language, to listen to the difference in nuance, which of course is just I just love languages, and I love learning, and I love listening, and I love being able to listen to Italian and to be able to tell that that person comes from North Italy, and that person is from Southern Italy, and that person is from Napoli. Only people from Napoli speak Italian like that.
The connections Jessie Norman forged with the world through language and culture only broadened her musical aspirations. She now loves to sing jazz, and she scats, and she has sung a lot of music throughout her career that wasn't in the proverbial rulebook for an operatic soprano. Spirituals and the music of Leonard Bernstein, the Gershwins, and Duke Ellington. One of the most surprising, she told Barbara Harrison, was probably when she sang Elvis Presley's It's Now or Never on stage with Sting, Bruce Springsteen, John Bon Jovi, Billy Joel, and Elton John. It was at a fundraiser to protect the rainforest. The only recording I could find of it was one posted on YouTube by someone in the audience that night. So it's a little rough, but it'll give you the idea.
One of the things, when I talk to younger performers, whether they're singers or violinists or pianists, I feel that I have encouraged them to go beyond the limitations of the box in which we can be placed as classical performers. Why should a person who's playing the Brahms second piano concerto not be interested in the ragtime music of Scott Joplin? Why should a singer who's singing Mimi, a Puccini, not be interested in the music of Cole Porter? I feel that we so often limit ourselves because we think that we have to follow a certain line, that we have to follow and do what's been done before, instead of finding our own paths and making our own way. I hope that my performance life encourages particularly other singers not to be limited, not to be put into a box and to be told you are that kind of soprano, so therefore this is the kind of music that you're supposed to sing. I said one clever thing, and I say this all the time, I said one clever thing in my entire life, And I was asked this question when I was about 23 or 24 years old, when I was sort of doing, you know, probably the second interview I'd ever done in my life. And the interviewer said, well, I mean, what kind of soprano are you? I mean, you sing this and you sing that, and you've got sort of fioraturi possibilities, meaning sort of like coloratura sopranos. So what kind of soprano are you exactly? And so then I said, in all of my sort of 23 or 24 years, I think that pigeonholes are only comfortable for pigeons.
Brilliant. A brilliant response. And I think that's one of the questions people have asked for many years about you.
Yes.
Where does your voice belong? Yeah. Where does it go? Uh-huh. And you have answered every time, anywhere I want it to go.
Exactly. Well, whatever we're doing, sort of this concert, this is the kind of soprano that I am, yes.
But there are not many singers, not many sopranos, not many people who sing opera who can do that, who can fit their voice to a part.
Well, I think that that is unfortunately the truth, but I think it has a great deal to do with listening to one's handlers and one's agents and all of that, because they'd like to know how to sell you. So if you sing these roles, then they will know what to do. I'm not trying to accommodate them. I'm just trying to live my life in song.
Jesse Norman, speaking in 2012 to reporter Barbara Harrison for the Academy of Achievement. Ms. Norman is now retired from the stage, but she remains involved in work on behalf of AIDS research, the homeless, and many other causes. She's received too many honors to name, but they include a National Medal of Arts, a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, a Kennedy Center honor, and recently, the 2018 Glenn Gould Prize. Her hometown of Augusta, Georgia also honored her by creating a Jesse Norman School for the Arts to nurture talent and creativity in kids from underserved communities. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Funding for What It Takes comes from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and of course, a big bravo to you for listening.